Today is the 8th in an ongoing series of shiurim on the issue of halachic change and the factors involved in halachic change. As you heard from him, next week will be our last shiur, which means we'll have 9 in total. I'll talk a little bit in a second about what I hope to do next week. So far, we have really looked at history. We've looked at the development of the halachic process in terms of when it is and when it isn't open to change, areas in which it has changed. We looked in great detail at the issues of Nishtane Hateva and scientific issues. We've covered a lot of ground. We must have covered at least 250 Makairos over the last seven, eight Shiurim. Today I'm really talking about the present day. Where are we standing today? What is the world like? Especially with regards to the following. Last week we looked at certain what we call meta-halachic issues which push halacha in perhaps a more liberal direction, which push halacha towards more open interpretations, more flexibility, and we looked at issues such as Darchei Shalom, which sometimes overrides certain halachic issues, Kovod Habrius, etc., Eis La'asos Lashem, some availability of poskim to innovate within halacha. Today I want to look at the opposite, which is, what is it that makes halacha say no? What is it that makes halacha say, yes, technically maybe that would be okay, but it's osa? A statement which maybe we've heard a lot of. And I'd like to look at this from a halachic perspective, from a meta-halachic perspective, and then at the end from a social perspective. I'd like to analyze a little bit of a very famous article which was written 15 years ago by Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, in our final session, I'd like to shift our time machine into forward gear and look at the future, insofar as anyone can, and look at the Makairos on what will happen in the future with Halacha. How will Mashiach influence the development of Halacha? Will we be able to basically start all over again? What will we be able to get rid of, to innovate, to change? There's a lot of very interesting material on this. Of course, we have to be a little bit circumspect. We don't really know exactly what's going to be, but we can definitely talk about it, and it itself makes, I think, a fascinating study, and we'll see the Rambam and the Ramban and how they approach this issue. But today, let's have a look at where we are in the present day. I've started with something which says here, halachic glass ceilings. It's mar hilchus. Something we haven't talked about so far, but we need to talk about. Because this is a source of what are the reasons why you find certain poskim are strict, and other poskim seem to be more flexible on certain issues. And this is one of a number of reasons why that might be. Let's have a look here. We'll start with the Mishnah in Eduyos, in number one. Lama maskirin divrei hayochid bein hamarubim. Why is it, says the Mishnah, about itself? The Mishnah is talking about itself. Why do we include minority opinions? Hoil vein halacha elik divrei hamarubim, since the halacha follows the majority based on the pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim, achrei rabim lehasos. Says the Mishnah, she'im yira beis din es divrei hayochid, because if a future beis din will see the minority opinion, the yismuch alav, it will be able to rely on that. She'ein based in Yochel Levatel Divrei based in Chaver, because a later based in cannot override an earlier based in Adshir Gadol Mimenu B'Chochma Minyan, until it's greater in Chochma, in wisdom, and Minyan, in following. We talked a bit about that at the beginning of the course. So the Mishnah, conscious of the fact that later Batei Din, later Poskim, will not be able to overrule the Mishnah, includes minority opinions to be there for a rainy day. They're there for you when you need them. That's why we're including them. How available are those minority opinions? Because obviously that introduces a large amount of flexibility, potentially, into the halacha. So the Rivard, commenting on this, the Rivard lived, of course, in France, around 1,000 years after the Mishnah. So it says the Rivard like this: Doimel zeh haloshen she'ein based in Achron yochel lismach al divrei hayochid. It seems from this language, he says, that the later based in may only rely on the earlier based in ela b'shas adchak, in a situation of need, of a pressing need. She'ein based in yochel levatel, it said, because a later based in cannot override an early one. Kolomer, that means Peres b'shas adchak nami, even in a shas adchak, ilmalishim su divrei hayochid, if it wasn't for the fact that you had this minority opinion, harishon, that came earlier, shehayacholikim ahem, which had already disagreed with the mainstream opinion, loy hayala achron rishay lahatir ma she'osru harishim. The later one would never have had the ability to overrule the earlier one. So he's limited the availability of minority opinions to shas adchak, pressing need, which of course is not an absolutely clear definition. It will really depend from case to case. He goes on, and I'm not really going to look into this in detail, to give another interpretation of the Mishnah, which is much more liberal, which allows you to rely on the minority opinions whenever you like. Just have a look at it briefly. But Mishnah, it could alternatively be, he says, that the reason, the explanation of this Mishnah is Tamache, it's giving an alternative option. It's saying, if the later Beis Din decides it wants to follow the minority opinion, Harishon, which came earlier, it's allowed to do that whenever it likes, not just in a Shas Adchak. As we found in the Amoraim, in the later Amoraim, if you look at the Gemara, he says, it's not always the case they follow the majority. Sometimes they decide to follow a minority that came earlier. So the Ravid gave two, if you like, understandings of this Mishnah. One more stricter and one more liberal. Can we rely on minority opinions whenever we feel like it, or only b'shas adchak? So my understanding is pretty much everybody has followed the more restrictive understanding of this Mishnah, and has said that the minority opinions which are out there in the Talmud and in the later authorities are available, but only b'shas adchak. And the Ramah, who paskens this in Shulchan Aruch, limits it even a little bit further. Aval ein sonchin, number three, al divrei kotten, neged divrei gadol mimenu b'chochma minyan. You can rely, he says, on a minority opinion, but only ein, one second, ein, you can rely on them. Afil b'shas adchak, you can only rely on them. You can rely on them in a shas adchak, but ella, but only in kain hayagam kain hefsed marumah, in a situation where there is a significant loss as well. So, in other words, these minority opinions are still in play, but it's not a free for all. You have to first check a few boxes. You have to say, well, to what extent is this a lechatchila? Is this an ideal situation? Or is it really a shas adchak? Shas adchak will mean a situation where there's some kind of pressing need, some kind of social need, some kind of imperative that we cannot follow the majority opinion because people's lives are being adversely affected in whatever way. And he also wants you to say hefsed merubah as well, that there's some kind of significant loss. If there's no real loss, then why do you need to follow this lenient opinion? Why not go with the mainstream opinion? So what you're seeing here is something of a limitation within the mainstream halacha of the ability to rely on these minority opinions. Again, one of the things that distinguishes the orthodox from the conservative tshuvas is the conservative tshuvas are less interested in these kind of halachic frameworks. And they're more interested in just going for any minority opinion whenever they see it. That's not really part of the halachic process. You cannot ignore the way that the halacha looks at the halacha. There's a certain lack of intellectual honesty in that. If you're part of the halachic process, you have to be part of it. And the Ramah is the Shulchan Aruch, and the Shulchan Aruch has decided how we view the halachic process. Yes. No, he says you have to have a shas adchak and a hefsed merubah. He seems to be saying both. Hefsed merubah, I'm not sure it's only going to be a financial equation. Hefsed merubah, it could be all sorts of areas. I mean, let's maybe talk about somebody who is stuck in a house on Shabbos because of their inability to get out due to the Eruv being apostle according to many opinions, but in kosher according to minority opinions, and therefore the wife will be unable to go out for lunch ever again until the baby's old enough to walk. Would that be considered to be a shas adchak? Would that be a hefsed merubah? That would be an interesting debate. On the posting, we had a very interesting situation in London where we had a disabled woman who wished to be wheeled before there was an Eruv. wished to be wheeled through the streets of northwest London to go to shul, because she wanted to go to shul. She asked shaylas of different people, and some of the rabbonim said, look, you know, I understand you want to go to shul, but you're not mechuyev to go to shul. You don't need to go to shul. You don't have an obligation to daven in a minyan, and therefore you can daven at home. Why is there a hefsed merubah? Why is there a significant loss? Why is this really a shas atchak at all, to allow you to rely on the opinions that a non-Jew can push you in an area where there's no, you can't come? And other rabbonim said, no, you're not taking account of the importance of going to shul for this particular woman. This particular woman is depressed and is unhappy, if she, maybe not clinically depressed, but she's not happy if she can't go to shul. Some women really want to go to shul. Some don't. Some men also don't want to go to shul. But they don't get any choice in the matter. Women at least can have some kind of option. So there were poskim in the town that said that she could come to shul, wheeled by a non-Jew. And it depended how they saw this issue of shas adchak. To what extent was she really losing out by not coming to shul? So it's a good question whether it's only financial or not. And you can imagine those situations in many slightly unclear areas where different people can view it different ways. Eruvim, which rely on minorities in order to be kosher, is a similar kind of area. It's very easy to passel the Eruv. No, it's not allowed, etc. And of course, there's a lot of politics also with Eruvim many, many times. Not all politics, but there is often politics. When it's appropriate to rely on a Heksha that's only a minority opinion, on an Eruv, this is all going to come into the frame. The Shach, you should know, the Shach in number 4, and this already is not agreed on by everybody. We saw a reference to this by Rabbi Lichtenstein in a previous year. The Shach asks a very interesting question. It's philosophically a very sound question. How could you uproot the Torah, the Hefsed Merubah, just because it's a financial loss? How does that work? Isn't that what God wants? God says this is a halacha. The majority fixes the halacha. So that's it. God said in the Torah, follow the majority. Who cares if it's a financial loss? You know, if the food is treif, it's treif. Ah, but you're going to suffer financial loss. No, it's treif. What can you do? He brings a wonderful proof. We would kill people in the Beis Din with the time when we had capital punishments. And put people into cherem, make things hefko. The Beis Din would decide if there were 71 members on the Sanhedrin and 50 said kill him and 21 said don't. So the guy's finished. He's chayev misa. The Hari ain lecha hefsed merubah gadol mazeh. Well, the guy's going to turn around and said, well, I feel this is a case of hefsed merubah. You know, you're about to chop my head off. Why can't we rely on the minority here? Good kasha, right? Good question. Comes along the Shach and says, v'nira, therefore it seems, halacha psukihi, she'ein samchin ala kotan negid agodl, you can only rely on the minority opinion over the majority, v'loi v'yachid negid rabim, and the one opposite the many, ela inken she'esh hefsed merubah, if there's a hefsed merubah, like we saw, a significant loss, mishkachas la desom chaleim, v'hainu duhu isa derabonon, and that's only if it's a derabonon. But time, and the reason for it is, the heim amru, this issue, heim omru, v'heim omru, is very common as a phrase. When the rabbis brought in a new din, when they introduced new legislation, so they're entitled to say under which circumstances it does apply and under which circumstances it doesn't apply. So they can turn around and say, we're making up a new rabbinic law, and if there's a hefsed merubah, it doesn't apply. Say that. They made the whole law in the first place. They can make the rubric. But when it comes to a Dvar Torah, when it comes to a Daraisa, who said you can play around with hefsed merubah? So he restricts it. So according to the Shach, your room for maneuver has now gone down another notch. Not only can you only rely on a minority when there's a shas adchak and there's a significant loss, but only if you can first establish that this is a rabbinic law. Now, of course, the good news, if you're looking for a heter, is a large amount of halacha that we have today is indeed the rabbana. A large amount of the ritual halacha, if you like, in kashrus, and the way the kitchen works, and the things that go wrong in the kitchen, spoons that drop into other things, a lot, not all, but a lot of that is the Rabbanan, and much of Hilchos Shabbos, that we encounter on a weekly basis is Drabon, and therefore the Shach will still allow things to work in that way, but much isn't. There's stuff which is Doraisa, and according to many poskim, immediately the first question when you address a Shach and say, look, I'm in a bind, I really need some kind of a lenient opinion, first thing he'll have to work out, is it Doraisa, is it Drabon? And according to the Shach, if it's Doraisa, there's much, much less room for manoeuvre. Now, not everybody agrees with the Shach. And I haven't got time to go into the Shach Levatari, all the deals, exactly who and who not. And there are indeed poskim that will bring minority opinions into the frame in a Doraisa too. But you should just be aware that there is a limited room for manoeuvre if you happen to be a posek who you come from a tradition where this Shach is the halacha, then you're less likely to get a heta out of that rabbi. Not, it's perhaps a bad way of putting it, to get a heta out of someone. But from the point of view of the questioner, wondering why it is that every time I ask Rabbi X, he always tells me no. But Rabbi Y is not quite like that. It's not because Rabbi X is less sensitive or less, you know, in touch. He may be, but it's not necessarily because of that. It could be because just he's got this halachic restriction. He cannot be mekel in a deraisa. Yes. Yes, but as important doesn't mean the same in all respects. Look, we all know that we live in a world, and always have lived in a world, where there is a significant Yetzer Hara amongst people not to follow Drabonot. We know this, because people, and I've heard this so many times from people of all ages, if God wants me to do something, then I'll go along with that, but I don't like rabbis. I don't trust rabbis. I had bad experiences with rabbis. And people's bad experiences with the local rabbi is extrapolated onto Chazal, which is one of the reasons why Chil Hashem is so tragic. Because if someone has a terrible experience with their local rabbi down the road, then that's the way he'll view all rabbinic issues, which is a big problem. That, of course, is a Yetzer Hara, and therefore there's a lot of effort that goes into educating people. You must keep the Rabbanos, you must keep the Rabbanos, you must realize it's how serious. And indeed, the Gemara says, I think it's Gemara in Erevin, that if you break a Drabbanon, it's Chayv Misa, Bidei Shamayim. It's very, very serious. And of course, every Drabbanon on a certain level is itself a Doraisa, because the Torah contains two mitzvahs, a positive and a negative mitzvah, and certainly according to the Rambam's analysis, really every Drabbanon is a Doraisa as well. So yes, absolutely. However, that doesn't mean that all of the rules that deal with Doraisa are the same as the rules that deal with Rabbanon. In fact, on the contrary, the Rambam makes clear that the rabbis were very careful to give rabbinic legislation different rules, so there shouldn't be any suggestion of Baal Tosef, of adding on to the Torah. So you shouldn't think, chas v'chalila, that lighting Shabbos candles is a Torah mitzvah. Because then that becomes the 614th mitzvah. And muksa becomes the 615th. And Hanukkah candles, etc. Which is itself an issue. So yes, the rabbonos are very important. But they are handled very differently in many areas of halacha. Sofik the rabbonon lekula. When there's a question in the rabbonon, we often go, not always, we often become lenient. We accept certain testimony in court on a rabbinic issue, which we wouldn't accept on a deraisa. We believe certain people with a drabbanon that we wouldn't believe with a deraisa. You can send your kids to do bedikas chometz on Erev Pesach because that's drabbanon, and you can trust them if they say they looked and they searched and they didn't find anything. But you can't send them to do tefilas kelim because tefilas kelim is a deraisa and it needs someone who has a name, etc. We could talk all morning. So they're very important, but they're different instruction. Now, look at number 5, please. Yes. Hefsed Merova, and it's also Midrabanan. Yes. Look at number 5. Here's another restricting factor which, depending on who you ask, is going to affect the psak that you get. The Gemara says an interesting thing. Masav Asa Rebbe Karebi Lezer. Rebbe, who wrote the Mishnah, or put together the Mishnah, wanted to rely on the minority opinion of Rebbe Eliezer. La'acha Sheniskar, once he'd remembered, we'll see in a minute what he remembered, Amar, he said, Kedai hu Rebbe Eliezer lismuch alav b'shatat chak. I can rely on Rebbe Eliezer because it's a Shav Sadchak. This, of course, is a nice support for the Raivad's first view, which we follow, which is that you can only rely on minorities in a Shav Sadchak. Says the Gemara, Ma'ala Achashunis, what did he remember? What was it that he had to remember before he felt able to rely on this minority opinion, which he did? Says the Gemara, he remembered, Deloi itmar chilchas aloi kamar v'loi kamar. That the halacha had not been fixed, had not been decided, itmar, had not been said one way or the other. From this, the Gemara introduces, and this is brought in many places, the concept of itmar hilchasa. And I want to explain what this means. Itmar hilchasa means that in certain areas of halacha, there is now a consensus. And the fact that there are minority opinions floating around out there means nothing. Effectively, they're now out of play. That's it, finished. There's a line drawn under the halacha, and you cannot anymore go back to these minority opinions. Now, where you draw that line of itmar hilchasa will depend on who you ask. Because once you've drawn that line, then you've basically shackled yourself. You've basically said, I now cannot go back beyond that line, and I'm only working forward from there. Classically, there was a major dispute between people like the Chazon Ish, who regarded, to a large degree, the Shulchan Aruch as an itmar hilchasa, and Rav Moshe Feinstein, who regarded the Gemara as an itmar hilchasa. In other words, when you, and I'm not talking about your local rabbi, I'm talking about a big poisek, regarding the Shulchan Aruch as itmar hilchasa. Meaning, if I go to a poisek and there's a real shas hadchak and it's a really difficult situation, is he able to basically just brush aside all of the halachic material back to the Gemara and go back to first principle, learn the sugya and come up with an innovative answer, which is what Rav Moshe often did? Or does he turn around and say, what can I do? The Gemara is, of course, very broad on this issue, but the Shulchan Aruch's pasuk. That's it. We cannot start reopening the Shulchan Aruch. And this, in the area of Psak, is a very, very big debate. And one of the things, I'm just trying to explain to you, one of the things that distinguishes what people think of as more innovative poskim, people are always hearkening to, oh, well, you don't find people like Rav Moshe Feinstein anymore. People are very restrictive. And before you are too quick to ascribe social reasons to that, which there will be as well, we'll see, there are also halachic reasons. If you hold itma hilchasa at a later date, that's it. If you hold itma hilchasa back to the Gemara, then you've got more flexibility. Of course, no one goes behind the Gemara. We saw that already at the beginning. Again, the conservative movement don't care about that. They're not worried about going beyond the itma hilchasa in the Gemara. But in the Orthodox world, the Gemara is the bottom line, but there may be other lines drawn above that, and that is also going to have a very important impact on the whether your Rav gives you a yes or a no. Look over on page 6, number 2. Says the Chazon Ish, Soif Davar. Oh, is there two number sixes? Oh, there really? Oh, page 2, number 2. Oh, I thought my numbering system had gone wrong then. For 1 minute. Okay, let's have a look at number 6. Soif Davar. The bottom line of accepted psak from our rabbi, says the Chazon Ish, Hashem ipihem anu chaim, because we live through their psak, k'moy maran habet Yosef, like the Bet Yosef, okay, the Magin Avraham, and the Magin Avram, the Hamishna Brura, and the Mishna Brura, he hara mekuyemes, this is established ruling, k'moy mipi Sanhedrin v'lishka the goddess. Almost as if it was said by the Sanhedrin itself, all the way back in the temple. In other words, the word of the Bet Yosef, the word of the Magin Avraham, the word of the Mishna Brura, is to us sacred, like the word of the Sanhedrin. They're strong words. And that really is now establishing like a new marker in halacha, saying, don't you dare go behind that. That's now the beginning point for all the discussion. That's right. And by the way, he often does disagree with the Mishna Brura. But yes. But because he's not saying that I'm not allowed to disagree with the Mishnah Brura, he's saying that if you want to know where the basic psak, normally speaking, starts from, he's saying the Mishnah Brura is Mekubal. The Jewish world has accepted the Mishnah. Now we'll talk about the Mishnah Brura soon, because the Mishnah Brura's acceptance in the Jewish world is a relatively recent thing. Nowadays, people who are brought up in halacha feel that, well, how could anyone ever know anything before the Mishnah Brura? That's a product of the last 50 years. And if and when we look at Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's article, when he harkens back sort of nostalgically to the era before the last 50 years, we'll see that the Mishnah Berurah was not in play. But here, so far we've looked at really very halakhic, very technical issues which justify a conservative approach to Psak Halacha. Conservative with a little c, not with a big c. Conservative as in not liberal. Okay? Right. Mishnah Berurah was after the Shulchan Aruch. He's saying, look, he's trying to draw lines and saying that this is a consensus in Halacha. Right, right, but not before. But not before. Okay? Now, let's get on to more macro issues. Where do we sometimes find that things are actually halakhically totally allowed? But the rabbis say you can't do them anyway. Let's have a look. The Mishnah in Chagiga has a fascinating discussion about Shavuos. Shavuos, nowadays, given a fixed calendar, can only fall on certain days of the week, but it used to be could fall on any day of the week. Whichever day Shavuos fell, you only have one day of Shavuos, at least if you're in Eretz Yisrael. And whereas Pesach and Shavuos, you had lots of options to catch up on your sacrifice if you didn't get to bring your Korban Re'iyah or Korban Chagiga on the Yontzef day itself, so you had another 5, 6, 7 days afterwards. What's going to be on Shavuos? If you missed it, you missed it. So the answer is no. Shavuos also comes with a 7-day window afterwards where you could catch up on your Korban if you missed it on the first day. The Shaila here the Mishnah is dealing with is, what happens if Shavuos fell on Shabbos? Well, if Shavuos fell on Shabbos, then most of the voluntary Korbanos were not able to be brought. They all had to be put off till Sunday, and Sunday became a kind of little mini Shavuos, like a substitute Shavuos. But there's a problem with that. Because there was a group of people in the Jewish people then, the Sadducees, who completely were focused on making sure that Shavuos was always on Sunday. Because they looked at the pasuk, Mimacharat HaShabbat. It says you start counting Mimacharat HaShabbat. And the way the Tzedukim understood that is literally, and they said, look, if Pesach falls on Tuesday, so Pesach is on Tuesday, you start counting Sfiras HaOmer from the following Sunday, and Shavuos will be 7 weeks thereafter. Shavuos, therefore, according to the Tzedukim, didn't always fall 7 weeks after Pesach. It often fell a little bit more. It was always, however, on a Sunday. And they do all sorts of stuff to try and make sure that the dates fell out on Sunday. Hence, the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah that says originally they used to announce the new moon, how? By beacons. However, people started messing around with the beacons and putting them on the wrong dates. Why? In order to engineer that Shavuos ended up on a Sunday. So they had to send messengers, etc., etc. Now, so says the Mishnah, what happens if Shavuos fell on Shabbos? So Sunday's not really Shavuos, but it becomes almost like Shavuos because everyone's bringing their korbanos. So on the one hand, that's fine. On the other hand, all the Tzedukim are going to go, you see, the rabbis, you see, they agree with us. They agree with us that Sunday's like a Shavuos. So have a look at number 7. Says the Mishnah, Moedim. Everyone agrees she'im chali yos b'Shabbos, that if Shavuos falls on Shabbos, Shiyom Tavuach, that the day for the sacrifice of a korban is Achar Shabbos, is on Sunday. However, the Ein Kohen Gadol Mislabesh B'Kelav, but the Kohen Gadol is not allowed to wear his fancy clothes. Umutarim Behesped V'Tai, so we're going to allow people to give a Hesped and to fast on that day. Why? It should be a Yontif day. It should, normally, if it was any other day, it would be awesome to do these things. Shalai lakayim divrei ha'ayim, so that you won't give any support for those people to say, the who say, atzeres achar Shabbos, that Shavuos has to be on Sunday. Already in the Mishnah itself, very ancient source, we see that we have to be careful that even doing something which is halachically totally permitted, if other people are going to see that and say, you see, it's our idea and they're catching on to the modernization of Judaism, then we're not allowed to do stuff which would have been allowed otherwise. Now, where does this lead? Is this a thin end of the wedge? How much are we not going to do just because the other guys are going to start pointing fingers going, you see? You know, it's a very, in a sense, it's a very negative way of defining what we do. You know, why don't we plant trees? Why doesn't the, quote-unquote, ultra-Orthodox world plant trees on Tu B'Shvat? Because the other guys do that. Because the other guys do that. And why doesn't it learn Tanakh all the time? Because the other guys do that. One of my Rebbeim once rather sort of sardonically commented to me, it's a good job the other guys don't learn Gemara, because otherwise what would we do? Yeah? So whoever the other guys are. So the truth is, I want to see how this is actually applied. What do we not do just because the other guys do? Oh, that's one example. Yes. Right. Interesting. Because so you wouldn't think for 1 minute, no one can point the finger and say, look, even the Sama Hasidim at Tzionim. Have a look. What's this? Heterodox means of a belief which is with multiple beliefs. Heterodox means, as in heterogeneous. Non-orthodox beliefs. As opposed to orthodox. Heterodox is opposed to orthodox. The word orthodox was rather a rude word which was applied by the non-orthodox to label the orthodox. Orthodox means narrow thinking. Yes. It has negative connotations. Not anymore. It has negative connotations. Rather like the word frum had negative connotations in its original sense, but doesn't anymore. Yes. So they had their shavuos on Sunday. That they have no choice; they have to bring their kibbutz. But they dafka downplayed the nature of the yontzef on the Sunday, so that people wouldn't think that we'd given in, if you like.
But we did bring the korbanos.
Yes, we did, because we have no choice. We've got to bring the korbanos. But we did it without all the frills and bells and whistles. Okay, look at another example of a gemara in Chulin. Let's go. Ein shoicht in leguma kol ike. You're not allowed to shecht into a pit. I'm not getting into all the details of shechita, etc. Aval oisig gum betoch beisoy b'shvel shikanes adam lesoich. If you're shechting a cow in your house, you can make a little ditch so that you don't make the floor messy. I'm not getting into the whole detail. However, says the Mishnah, says the Gemara, ubashuk, but if you're in public, lo yasekein, you must not make a ditch. Why? Shelo yechake esat tzedukim haminim. You're not allowed to give any support, because for whatever reason, I don't even know what the Mishigas was. They had a Mishigas. You have to shecht into a pit. And even though from a halachic perspective it's entirely neutral, you can shecht into a pit, onto the floor, you can do what you like. Nevertheless, because these guys made a big deal out of it, we're not allowed to do it publicly. And Rashi explains that yachzik yedehem b'chukoseihem. Yichake means we will strengthen their chukoseihem, their practices. Yichake is loshen chayk. And I brought you a very interesting four lines from Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg in the which was printed up in Tchumen. Tchumen is a very interesting and excellent journal of different halachic and hashkafic articles, which runs to many, many volumes now, 30 or more volumes. And Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, who is a frequent contributor to Tchumen, he writes in the 18th volume there as follows. Tfilas hanoshim kashehein atufois betalis. Women's tfilah, when they are dressing, they're wearing talesim, when they're reading from the Torah, mechazekes es ha-reforma. Okay? This gives strength to the reform movement. Even though, of course, strictly speaking, why would a women's public tefillah be halachically problematic? There's nothing halachically wrong with a group of women coming together to daven. And even if they choose to use a sefer Torah, technically speaking, it's very difficult to find what exactly could be wrong with that. Okay, so they won't make the brachas, there's no minyan. They'll read from a sefer Torah. Fine. You can find fault with it, but it's difficult to halachically answer it. And if the woman wants to wear a talis, on what grounds exactly are you going to tell her it's osur for her to wear a talis? All of these things individually are very halachically borderline, if not permitted. Comes along. We'll come to Rav Soloveitchik in a minute. Says Rav Zalman Nechemya, you can't do it because it strengthens reformer. Kol chikoy shel apikorosim, and anything that strengthens the chikoy, the chukim, the rules of apikorosim, osa hum mehatayra. It's osa dorisa doraisa. And he brings from the Avnei Nezer based on this, these Mishnahs and Gemaras that we've seen. Achein, however, ilu be'emes haisa isha choshekes b'kiyom mitzvah she'ein hi metzuvah ba. tzuvah. If a woman genuinely wants to keep a mitzvah that she is not obligated to do, wants to go beyond and do something extra, haisa oisiz ois b'chedra, she could do it, and she should do it, in private. And then there can be no suggestion that she's supporting or giving strength to the reform movement. Anyone who does something in public, in a public way, borrow, and you can disagree with this. I mean, the people, you might not quite see it this way, but says Rav Zalman Lechemi, a borrow, it's clear from the fact that it's public, that the reason that they're doing it is for the wrong reasons. It's coming from the reform, coming from a liberalizing egalitarian agenda. The Alkane who also, and that's why it's also. And we find this historically in a number of innovations that have been proposed, which are halachically very neutral. Having an organ in the synagogue. What's wrong with having an organ? Okay, we won't play on Shabbos. But we'll have an organ in the synagogue, and during the week, if there's a wedding, we can play Here Comes the Bride, I don't know, we can play something nice, we can play Jewish tunes, you know, Oyd Yishama V'Ari Yehuda, and on the organ. It doesn't have to sound just like the royal wedding, it can sound Yiddish kind of wedding. It comes along with Robertsy Hoffman in a long tshuva, which I brought you in number 10, where this was a big push at the time, and says, no, awesome. Totally awesome. You cannot have an organ in your shul because it gives support to the apikorsim. Look at the first line of the tshuva number 10. Shenina b'masis in chulin, we see in chulin, which we saw in number 8. Aval oise guma b'toich beso, etc. B'shuk lo yasekein, you cannot make a ditch to shechlin in public. Shelo yichake es minim, you can't support the apikorsim. Uperish Rashi, yachse gidei b'chukoseyem, yichake loshen choik. He brings Rashi, which means this is giving support to the apikorsim. V'yisa sham b'raita b'shuk lo yasekein mishum shenei b'chukoseyem lo yiselechu. There's an element of chukas hagoyim as well. V'yimasekein tzorech b'dik achrav. And if someone wants to do that, you have to check out whether they're really genuine. From this I say, says Rav David Tzvi Hoffman. By the way, Rav David Tzvi Hoffman was, let's put it positively, in many ways was a very progressive, innovative Rav in the school of Rav Shimshon Rofar Hirsch, in no way afraid of modernizing Judaism where necessary to give it strength and chizuk in the modern 20th century world. He lived at the beginning of the 20th century. He's not one of these people who is just kind of knee-jerk saying everything's osser, by any means. But this he felt really was. Even if you turn around and say that an organ is not really avodah zarah, mikol makom ein lahatira, you cannot allow it. Mishum, why? Shemachakeh b'zeh apikorsim, because it's supporting the apikorsim. And he goes on from there and says that really the reason why people want organs in the shul is because they just want it to look like a church, etc., etc. Okay, so the reform movement, certainly in his day, was apikorsis. It denied the basic fundamental principles of Judaism. They are the people who want to make Judaism look more Christian. So if we go along with that, even because for the best of reasons, that's supporting apikorsis. Because you see the reform movement will say, you see, even the local Orthodox shul now has an organ in shul. Another big issue, which was moving the bima to the front of the shul. It's hard for us today to even relate to how that was such a big issue, but it was such a big issue in many communities. We must move the bima up to the front of the shul. For reasons, obviously the church, the altar, Lahavdil, is at the front of the church. And in the reform shuls, the bima was immediately moved out to the front of the shul. And from a halachic perspective, this is really not such a big deal. It's not the biggest thing in the world, exactly where you put the bima in the shul. Okay, there are preferences in different ways based on the base of Mikdash, layout, etc. But the real reason why you can't move the bima is because the other guys move the bima. And therefore, if we do that, they're going to point to it and say, oh, you see, like flowers at a funeral, like someone just said before. Rav Herzog, listen to this, Rav Herzog, who was also, in many ways, progressive, in his halachic approach, the first chief rabbi of the state of Israel. He was very much part of the Tzioni movement. He was very opposed to people changing their pronunciation from Ashkenazis to a modern Israeli pronunciation, opposed very, because the reason people are doing this is because there's a whole group of people out there who feel that Ashkenazis is old-fashioned, and we have to get rid of the old Jew, the Polish Jew, the Eastern European Jew. We have to have a new Jew and an Israeli Jew and a new identity. He says this is a very traitor agenda. And he was no opponent of Zionism, religious Zionism. So let everyone speak Ashkenaz. What, do we should all speak like Sephardim? Yeah, we don't need unity. Doesn't mean we all have to do the same thing in the same way. That's not the Jewish idea of unity. We don't want everybody to be the same. But so even though many, and I know today many people who are very Orthodox people who are very opposed to Ashkenazis pronunciation. No, I think everybody agrees. Everybody agrees. Everybody agrees that you have to you know, speak modern Hebrew the way modern Hebrew is pronounced. Nobody is suggesting that you start speaking modern Hebrew in Ashkenaz. And by the way, you know, in the Haredi yeshivas, there's a total split. Modern Hebrew is spoken like modern Hebrew, and as soon as you go into learning Tehillim, davening, it switches to Ashkenaz. Interestingly, in the Beit Yaakovs, they tend to speak mostly and teach them even to read and learn in modern Havarat Sfardit. I'm sure they're a good, because of Ger decided to do that. So this is one of those touchy issues as to whether, you know, one can or cannot change. Yes. Oh. So Bat Mitzvah is an example which, in a sense, goes a little bit contrary to this. Because we saw a tshuva of the Sri Day Ace where he felt that actually when it comes to Bat Mitzvah, the reasons to do it are so strong that they override the danger that other people are going to point into. Because no question, Bat Mitzvah was a reform innovation. And yet he feels that Bat Mitzvah is so critical for the well-being and spiritual well-being of young women today that we have to introduce it. Even he had reservations, and in many parts of the Jewish world, Bat Mitzvah is simply not acceptable. But in many parts, it is. You have to do it a different way. So get it. Let's go on to page 3. Performing a bris in shul. A chuppah, absolutely. That's a good point. Having a chuppah in shul. I know rabbonim who, if you invite them to a chuppah and it's in shul, they'll say mazel tov, thank you, I wish you mazel brach, but I'm not coming. Let's go on to number 3. Yerushamayim. Yerushamayim is in short supply in many ways, and it's hard to pin down. In order for any halakhic innovation to be relevant and acceptable, it has to be coming from people who are deeply committed to connecting with the Dvar Hashem, to trying to do the right thing, and who are frightened of doing the wrong thing. And when I say frightened, I mean frightened. They feel a sense of trepidation that chas v'chalila we might make a mistake in halacha and people would be doing aveiras. There has to be that. If someone is coming with a glib approach where there's a rabbinic will, there's a halakhic way, that in itself is a clear indication of a total absence of Yerushamayim and therefore a total invalidation of any kind of suggestion of halakhic change. Even in the Sri Day Eish, we're in the Bat Mitzvah tshuva, who was really pushing Bat Mitzvah in many ways, he puts, and I've quoted two lines here, number 11, Ulamasa Hadava, Ulamasa in practice, Hadava Toli B'Kavonas Harotim L'Chadesh. Everything depends on the Kavona of those who wish to make changes. Okay, L'Chadesh Minhag Zeh, to make a new Minhag, Shel Hagigas Bas Mitzvah, celebrating Bas Mitzvah. Im Hein Miskavnim L'Shem Shamayim, are they really into it L'Shem Shamayim? Or Chalila L'Shem Chikui Haminim. Are they really doing it because of an underlying need to just, you know, change because they want to drift Judaism to... Doesn't it? I'm not so sure. It's very hard for people to say that they know what other people's kavanas are. And I've in the whole women's public minyanim thing, I've genuinely come across women who want to have public women's prayer service because out of deep l'shem shamayim reasons, because of deep commitment to tefillah and to meaningful women's involvement in tefillah. And I've come across other people who at the end of the day have an egalitarian agenda. There's a mixture of people. And I think that's true of almost all of these areas. It's very hard to find the right people. Yes. Chukas Agoy is a posuk. It's a mitzvah d'oraisa. V'chukaseihim lo teilechu. So, no is the answer to that. But it became more prevalent because once the boundaries between the non-Jews and the Jews began to come down, there was more of a chance of Jews integrating, adopting, and innovating non-Jewish practices.
So how do you get away with weddings? Like in America, I'm sure England is the same way.
Weddings what? You know something? There's a very big debate in the halacha of chukat agoy. What is chukat agoy? You know, non-Jews wear sneakers. That's chukat agoy. Now, Jews can't wear sneakers. That's nothing to do with chukat agoy. It's to do with sneakers. But, you know, where do you draw the line between chukat agoy? Non-Jews wear ties. Is ties a chukat agoy? Some chassidim call it kesher shel rishoyim. So, according to the Vilna Gaon, chukat agoy is only a problem when the minhag has some kind of religious significance to the non-Jews. The way you dress, like dressing in a dog collar. In England, it was very common, even 50, 60 years ago, for the rabbis of Orthodox shuls to wear dog collars, white dog collars, and black robes, like priests. And there's no question that was an adoption of a Christian clergy dress, okay? Canonicals. What is that chukat agoy or is it not chukat agoy? Well, today you'd never get away with it. But having an aisle for the wedding, does the fact that the bride walks up the aisle have deep religious significance in Christian understanding? I don't know, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Throwing confetti and things was an old Jewish minhag. It's brought down. They used to throw things on the bride, all sorts of things. And also, sometimes it's difficult to know which way round things are. You know, the reason the bishop of London dresses like he dresses is not because, you know, he thought of it, it's because the Kohen Gadol dresses that way. So, you know, who took what from who? Bar mitzvah is not mukubal by everybody. Except for a large number of the Hasidish world is not interested in bat mitzvahs. And I think, yeah, really? You see, the world is a-changing. Let's go on, because I have two major other subjects to deal with before we finish. Look at page 3, please. To what extent is halachic censorship justified? In other words, to what extent do we say to people things are osa, even when they're really mutter, but we don't trust them? In other words, let's put it bluntly, to what extent do we lie about halachic permissibility in order that people won't take liberties? And you may say, well, you know, you could never lie. You can never mislead people and say something is osa when really it's mutter. And the answer is, it's not so straightforward. And I want to show you a very interesting source that deals with this. Have a look in number 12. Amar Rav Nechamia Breder of Yosef. Hava kamina kameda rova. I was standing in front of rova. Hava kamava leschina apuma de dikula. And he was rubbing a knife on a tree. And this is dealing with the issue of sharpening knives on Yontif. Are you allowed to sharpen knives on Yontif? So the Gemara says he saw his Rebbe rubbing a knife in a way that looked as though he could be sharpening it. And I said to him, are you doing it to sharpen the knife? Or are you doing it just to clean the grease off the knife? Cleaning a knife, of course, is fine. Sharpening the knife is maybe not. But Amar Li, and he said to me, says Rav Nechemi Bar Rebbe Yosef, Rav said to me, Lahavisham Nunisa. He told me, I'm doing it to remove the grease. V'chazisi ledate, and I looked at it again carefully, and it was clear, lo lechadeh dekavet, that he was doing it to sharpen the knife. But he said, no, I'm not. I'm doing it to remove the grease. Ukasavar, because he's understanding my rabbi. He said, I know why my rabbi told me that. Because he felt halacha, that indeed it is the halacha that you can sharpen a knife. The ein moirin came, but you can't tell people. There is a category in halacha of halacha the ein moirin came. This is indeed permitted, but don't tell anybody. We'll see why night now. Let me give you another example in number 13. This deals with the issue of cooking on Shabbos. Hamavashal b'Shabbos b'shogei goichel. If someone cooks on Shabbos by accident, a Jew, b'shogei, if it was an accident, he didn't realize it was Shabbos or whatever, yoichel, you can eat it. B'mezid, lo yoichel, if you did it on purpose, you can't eat it. Divrei Rebbe Meir. This is Rebbe Meir's view. Rebbe Yehuda says is stricter. B'shogei yoichel b'motzei Shabbos. If he did it b'shogei, you could only eat it on motzei Shabbos. B'mezid, but if you did it on purpose, lo yoichel olamis, you can never eat it ever. So you have two opinions. Rebbe Meir is more relaxed, is more lenient about cooking on Shabbos. If someone, obviously you can't cook on Shabbos, but if someone did cook on Shabbos by mistake, you can eat it. And Rebbe Yehuda says you can't eat it. So what's the halacha? So the Gemara says, Ki mayri lehu rav letalmidei. When Rav, in the next generation of Amoraim, told this halacha to his students, mayri lehu ki Rebbe Meir. He told the halacha like Rebbe Meir. But ki dorish bepirke, but when he gave a public shir on Hilchas Shabbos, dorish ki Rebbe Yehuda. He told the halacha like Rebbe Yehuda, mishum amei haaretz. In other words, Rav understood the halacha was lenient, like Rebbe Meir. And when he was talking to his private group of Talmidim about the halacha, that's how he taskened. But when he's giving a public shir, he told everybody that this is osa, even though he holds its mutter, because they were amaratzim. And if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile. Now, this is an interesting, if a little dangerous, tool. You know, to what? Because on the one hand, you can only really do this if you're not going to get caught. Because once the Amoratsim catch on that you're teaching one way in the yeshiva and another way in the shir, then you know your cover's been blown, and of course it'll not only be bad, but it'll be worse than had you taught the halacha like that in the first place. Because now everyone's going to be going around saying the Rav makes it up as he goes along. He says things also when they're really mutter, and you know where there's a rabbinic will, etc. So this is a very tricky thing to do. If you look here in number 14, there's an extract from Encyclopedia Talmudit. I'm not going to read through the whole thing on the halacha of Ein Morin Kain, and it gives various examples through the Gemara in different places where rabbis have paskened a certain way, but they've only done that in order to make sure that people listen to what they say. Now, of course, it's difficult because there is a crowd of people that if you tell them, well, technically it is permissible, but it's really inadvisable, then that last part of the sentence has been kind of airbrushed out. All they've heard is, it's permissible. So what are you going to say to that group of people? They won't listen to you. Excuse me? Well, the technical concept of a geder means where Chazal make a halachic drabonon in order to protect against the doraisa, and there's no secret there. Everyone knows it's a drabonon, and they're doing because of this and because of that, etc., etc. We're here dealing with something which is more extra legal. It's extra halachic. It's the rabbi coming along and saying it's osa when really it's mutter, but he just doesn't trust you with mutter. Let me look, please, with me at page 4 for a second. At source number 16. And this is a very interesting Me'iri. The Me'iri learns the following. Amru, they say, in Gemara in Sanhedrin, Ein Moshivim B'Sanhedrin, you're only allowed a place on the Sanhedrin, and a Talmud Chacham Hayudel et Aheres Asheris Min HaTorah. If you're able to justify on halachic grounds why a sheretz, why a reptile which is clearly Tameh, if you can bring enough proofs to prove that it's tahor, if you can prove to me that pork is kosher, mina Torah, from Torah proofs, then you can have a place on the Sanhedrin. But if not, then forget it. What's going on here? What does this mean? Why are we, what kind of clever legalistic skills are we trying to encourage in our rabbis? You're playing devil, just to hone your legal skills, to make sure that you can think straight, so that you're... So the Me'iri... The Me'iri. So you're all saying that the rabbi needs to be able to do this so that he can anticipate other people and then he'll have an answer before they've even asked the question. That's obviously very important. The Me'iri gives a different answer. He says like this. V'yirali, it seems to me, the Peirush Davar Zeh, that the meaning of this expression is as follows. She'im yiru, takolas,
Yoitzis b'doraseim, if the rabbis were to see some kind of negative thing, a takala, something going wrong with society in their generation, ve'ezid din Torah, in any area of the Torah, yotze l'chadesh dinim, he should be able to bring in new laws, new rules, to add on or to take away on a temporary basis, and to justify doing this minatora from the Torah. In other words, the rabbi has to have the ability to say something because it needs to be said, not because it's halachically true, but because it needs to be said, and to justify why he's doing that from halachic grounds. And the Ga'onim have said from the dinim of the Talmud, sheyesh b'yad rabbonim or Ga'onim, the rabbis or the Ga'onim, even after the Talmud, have the right lachadesh gezeiros v'takonis, to make new rules, derech klal, in a general way, or derech prat, or in a specific way, or lahasir eze inyan mechu'are, in order to remove something very negative, according to what they understand in their time, besmach mu'at, with only very, very shaky halachic grounds. But they have to be able to do that. The Talmud has been given over to those experts, or the Bale Hasfora, people who can think very carefully, straight, and a choyne of a shikul hadas, who've got clear minds and understanding, and they can add on, etc., etc. Now, he gives a qualification to this. But most people are not allowed to do this. The only people who have this leeway, Ela Muflag Bedoiro, are the leaders, the greatest of their generation, the Yedia Ubacharifas or Piltul Mayushav Adas Mayushavas. People who have the greatest minds and the clearest das, etc. But you see here, and I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be telling you this, but you see here, and it's in the Meiri, it's not secret, the rabbis do have some grounds to rely on if they turn around and say things which need to be said in order to make people behave in a certain way. On a certain level, this is a sort of censorship, that I'm kind of changing the halacha just to achieve the ends I need. Someone told me a wonderful sign on a bus I think it was in Beitar, which was like a 3-point sign. It said, would you eat pork? No. Would you eat on Yom Kippur? No. Would you walk out of the house without tights on? No. Okay. They're all equal. Eating on Yom Kippur, not wearing tights. Now, I'm not getting into the whole issue as to whether you should or you shouldn't. It depends on minhag, it depends on all sorts of things. And in an area where the das yehud is to wear tights, and of course a person is halachically obligated to wear tights, that's not the point. The point is, it's not the same as Chilul Shabbos, and it's not the same as eating on Yom Kippur. It's not the same halachic area. But the poster is designed to make people think that it is, in order to get them to wear tights. So that's a great question. It could be, and you know something. Even when you have names of rabbis on the bottom of things, it means nothing. Their names are used, etc., etc. Good point. A good point. So the question is, how does it now? I have heard people say, and I think there's a lot of truth to this now. If this ever did work, and I suppose it did, and this is understandable as a power that maybe the rabbinic leadership has, it won't work anymore. And the reason is because, I think, two major reasons. Number one, access to information today is vastly, vastly different to what it was even 30 years ago, and certainly 100 years ago, and certainly 1,000 years ago. If you say something now and you say that the minimum requirements of the halacha are X, then everyone's going to be right on their Google searches, looking on and putting in this, that, and the other, and before you look around, they're going to have a CD-ROM and a Bar-Ilan, and they're going to have said this and that. They're going to have 28 Makairas while you're completely wrong. Okay? You can't pretend anything anymore because people have access to information. Also, the general level of education of the laity is much higher than it used to be. Now, it's not high enough to give most of these people a sensible opinion on most things. But it's high enough to make them think that they have a sensible opinion on most things. Right. And therefore, I don't think you can necessarily get away anymore so easily with, maybe. I don't think it's very easy to do, but I want you to be aware that this may be where some of the conservative little c agenda is coming from. Do we tell people? I get this in the seminary world a lot, I must tell you. Teaching seminary girls is a very big business these days. There's a lot of people coming, and I'm telling you, a lot of girls get told things with absolute clarity, halachic certainty, which are completely halachically wrong. The only reason they're told them is because the teachers feel that if they told them the actual technical picture and the sophisticated picture, they wouldn't do it. Now, I'm not getting into all the details. There's many, many instances. Personally, I feel that this is counterproductive because these girls have access to the information. They know when they're being lied to, and it undermines the integrity of the entire halachic process. Because when they turn around and say, well, my teacher from 11th grade told me with absolute certainty this was the case, and it's not, then probably everything else that she ever taught me, like Torah is min ha-shamayim, and there is a God in the world, is probably also, chas v'chalila, not true. And therefore, I understand why people do this, and it's to achieve a certain goal, but it's counterproductive, in my humble opinion, and I think it doesn't work anymore. And I think you have to trust your students. Now, you have to know when people can and can't cope with levels of complexity. There's no point learning a sugya in detail to people who are just not qualified and able to understand it. But it should be able to put across a sophisticated Torah message in language that most people can understand. Let's finish with one last comment, which is that whenever you're looking at this particular issue as to why does it feel that things are becoming stricter over the last 40, 50 years, and you constantly get this. I used to belong to the Golders Green Bay Samedrash, Munks, it's also called, to its friends in London, a shul in London, and you have real, you know, solid, old-time, you know, front people, yuckers who've been from the, you know, all Frankfurt, and, you know. And I often used to hear the refrain that the younger generation, in my time, we never had to do this, we never had to have separate seating here, we never had to do that. You know, some of it may be true, some of it may be less true. I often used to hear this. Why is everything suddenly not good enough anymore? Mm-hmm. You know, we were all from enough in 1950. Why all of a sudden, for our children, that's not good enough anymore? Now, some of the issues may be the technical, halachic or hashkafic issues we discussed. Some of it may just be nostalgia and wishful thinking. Maybe it wasn't ever good enough in some ways. But some of it may be due to the following. There is a classical article which frankly must be read. I reread it for the purposes of coming to this class today. I'd read it once before. I read it again. It's an article by Professor Chaim Soloveitchik in Tradition. He, of course, is the son of Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik. He wrote this article 17 years ago, where he was talking about the fact that things seem to be changing, or have already changed, in the Orthodox world, and things have become stricter. And he wants to try and trace this. I brought you a link, by the way, on the web. You can get this article free. I'm sure it's good to subscribe to Tradition. I recommend that too, and I'm also a subscriber. But actually, you don't have to subscribe to pick up this article. It's out there for free access. And he brings seven or eight reasons why what could be just socially, things have really frumed up a lot in the last 50 years. One of the things he says, and let's just look at them, he says there's been a move from religious justification of traditional mimetic observance. In other words, people used to do things because that's what they saw their parents do. How much matzah do you eat on Seder night? Well, my father, my mother, whatever they'll say, was they knew halacha, they were from people, they kind of ate, you know, sort of this much. And that's what we eat. To people today who base their halakhic observance less on what they saw, and maybe it could be because they didn't see anything, or what they saw was no longer useful, to based on textual analysis. I need a book, I need a little chart. I've seen people that say that, and I'm not knocking it, and it's important to eat the right amount. But these little plastic charts with this much matzo, this much, I'm quite sure if you'd have shown that to people 100 years ago, they'd have thought it was a joke. But of course, you know, that's where things have gone. There's, of course, and again, I'm not criticizing this. Maybe our generation needs this. And actually, Rav Soloveitchik is not overtly criticizing it either. There is an explosion of technical halachic books written on every conceivable subject. I have a book at home, and it's a great book. 1,000 pages on the halachas of saying hello. I'm not joking. 1,000 pages on the halachas of saying hello.
You're not joking, but isn't that a joke?
No, it's full of wonderful makoros. It's full of great scholarship. It's partly a product of the fact that we have a large number of very talented young men in Kol Olim who want to try and produce some kind of fruits of the labour of their learning, and therefore these books are coming out. But what it's also doing, says Rav Soloveitchik, what's that?
Yeah, I was just
going to
say.
I know. I don't think so. And you find books on every possible subject in Hebrew and indeed in English. And this is a modern phenomenon. A couple of other things. A move towards the halachic positions of the Vilna Gaon. Especially with the popularity and the popularization of the Mishnah Berurah. The Vilna Gaon's halachic positions were never practiced in Lithuanian Jewry. They just didn't catch on, because he was quite radical, and they had their own Masorah. He wasn't the Rav of Vilna, he wasn't the Rosh Hashiva in Vilna. Other people paskin halacha, and the communities of Vilna just didn't paskin like him. Never mind the rest of the Ashkenazi world or the Lithuanian world. The Mishnah Berurah very much brought the Psak of the Vilna Gaon into the mainframe, and because of the popularization of the Mishnah Berurah, so the Vilna Gaon's Psak halacha has now become very mainstream. Give you an interesting example. What time does Shabbos come in? So now everybody paskins, basically everybody paskins, like the Psak of the Vilna Gaon, which is the Shkia is the latest possible moment, and you have to add on a little bit to that, and you have to have 18 minutes before that. What happened to Rabbeinu Tam? The Shulchan Aruch paskins like Rabbeinu Tam. Many, many communities were noyeg like Rabbeinu Tam, which is that Shabbos comes in, the Issa Malacha comes in almost an hour after sunset and goes out later. Now, you won't find anybody today, almost, who is makel like Rabbeinu Tam. You'll find people who are machmir at the end of Shabbos like Rabbeinu Tam. But that's largely because of the Vilna Gaon and the fact that the Mishnah Berurah says, Chas v'chalila, you can't go against the Vilna Gaon and those who are like him on this. Now, again, we can't say that's right or wrong, but it's happened. It's changed. There is a debate in the poskim. Does Chadash apply in Chutz La'aretz or not? So, for generations, everybody was samech on the Bach. And the Bach says that there's no Chadash in Chutz La'aretz. And today, in the last, I'd say even in the last 20 years, this has caught on. Even after Rav Soloveitchik wrote this article, all of a sudden, now people, this is the thing to not paskalize the Bach, and therefore you can't eat under this Hesher, or this Hesher, or this Hesher. And again, I'm not saying it's wrong, maybe it's wonderful, but it's a change. For there was a major debate in the Achronim. Do you need a mechitza for seating at a wedding? On this, the Bach says you do. But the Levush said, that's not our minhag. We never had separate seating at weddings. And for generations, the minhag of people was like the Levush. They had mixed seating at weddings. Europe, from Poland. The same place as everybody. They were all from the same place. And now that's changed as well. The last couple of things here. A complication of practice due to textual reliance, again over mimetic practice. Texts are complicated. You need to get into more details when it comes to text. An adoption of the brisk halachic process. The briskers always took the view that we have to be choshesh for all the opinions and be yotzei according to everybody. This never used to be the mainstream approach. The mainstream approach is, well, there's a psak. You go to the Rav and he paskins. He doesn't paskin like those ones, and he does paskin like these ones. The brisker approach says, well, no, who knows? Maybe the other ones are right. You have to be yotzei according to everyone. This obviously pushes the halacha in a more machmir direction, and the Mishnah Berurah, to some degree, also adopts this. He looks at all the other Rishonim and says, well, we have to be Yotze according to everybody. No, how can you be a Makel on this? The Orach HaShulchan would take more the approach, well, this was never the Minhag. The Minhag was like this, and we have to justify and uphold the Minhag. Rav Soloveitchik talks about a response to acculturization and assimilation. This was a kind of rebound, a response to that, a reaction against that, a movement to secondary sources, especially English sources, away from primary sources. The centralization and dominance of high schools and yeshivas. Where do people get their Jewish values from? Today, it's not from the home, even in the frumest of the frum. It's from the yeshivas. You go to the yeshivas, and everybody comes back from the yeshivas with an institutionalized yeshiva approach. So you can have a Masorah, and I'm not talking even about Balei Tshuva. You can have a Masorah going back 20 generations. Your kids are going to go to a small number of standardized yeshivas, and they're going to come back saying this is not good enough. In Yerushalayim, we do it like this. And that's the end of that Masorah, finished. Because your kids will insist on a higher level of whatever. And you see this across the board. And also, and this is related, the movement of halachic authority from local rabbis and poskim to Rosh Yeshiva. And this is a very big move today. And again, you can debate whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, but it's a thing. The Rosh Yeshiva now have very much the final say on many, many, many halachic areas. And they are poskim, obviously, but they're not community rabbonim. They're not people on the whole who have access and have had decades of interaction with Balabatim. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky always used to say that one of the reasons why he was perhaps a little bit different in approach to others is because he wasn't just a Rosh Yeshiva, quotes and quotes. He was also a Roth. He also had a life of experience of real people with real issues. And this also changes things a lot. All of these reasons contribute to the shift that we see, and that shift will continue. I suppose we just have to live with it. But it's there. So we'll see next week where it's all going to end. All right?